When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What was the culture around injuries and pitching sore, pitching hurt back in those days?
Yeah, don't go in the training room.
Welcome into another episode of Baseball America's interview series From Phenom to the Farm, where we're talking to former professional baseball players to reminisce about their playing days and what they learned in their journey from amateur ball to the professional ranks. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. Today we are joined by Bob Tewksbury, 13-year big leaguer who has dedicated his post-playing days to sports psychology and mental skills coaching. He's worked with a few organizations, most recently the Cubs, and now is a private consultant. We dive a lot into that aspect of the mental side of the game. And if you've got more interest in that after the podcast, you can check out his book, 90% Mental, an all-star player turned mental skills coach reveals the hidden game of baseball. We also dive into a lot of good baseball stuff from Bob's era. Minor league lifestyle in the 1980s, very Bull Durham-esque, breaking in with a Yankees team that just had an incredible cast of characters, and what it's like to face future Hall of Famers in an all-star game. Episodes of From Phenom to the Farm drop every other Tuesday. If you enjoy this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast and go check out past interviews. And if you haven't yet, leave a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Also, make sure you subscribe to BaseballAmerica.com and the BA podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. The Prospect Handbook is available for pre-order, and the BA College Preseason Top 25 just dropped. The BA podcast feed is continuing to break down top 10 prospect lists and gearing up for college baseball season. For future guest info of this podcast, you can follow me on Twitter at Kyle Bandujo. But for now, let's talk to Bob Tewksbury. Joining in for today's episode of From Phenom to the Farm, he is a former big league pitcher and author of the book 90% Mental, an all-star player and mental skills coach reveals the hidden game of baseball. It's Bob Tewksbury. Bob, Tewks, thanks so much for joining.
Yeah, I like that, Tewks. Thanks, Kyle. No, it's... I was excited to get your email and inquiring about doing this, and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
The mental side of baseball has been such an important part of this series. I thought you were the perfect person to bring on. I want to get right into it. Tewks, growing up in New Hampshire, what was your athletic background? I've never been. I've heard New Hampshire is beautiful, heard great things. I cannot imagine that weather lends itself to year-round baseball.
No, we played... I think we played 14 games in high school, maybe. And I remember vividly, we had dugouts in high school that were sunken dugouts. And I think the first 2 weeks of the season, we sat on benches outside the dugout because there was still ice frozen in the dugout. But no, it was cold. I mean, cold baseball in New England is cold no matter what. But you know, very short season, you know, back then it was, a short high school season and then a very short summer season. It was, you know, Babe Ruth baseball and American Legion, the AAU programs and longer schedules and games and showcases hadn't been developed yet. So it was short, but yeah, New Hampshire's a beautiful place. And, you know, there's been a few, I was going to say it's not the hotbed of baseball development, but Carlton Fisk, Joe LaFay, Steve Balboni, Mike Flanagan, Rich Gale, to name a few. I'm probably forgetting somebody, but, you know, those are some big leaguers that came from Mike LaValier, catcher with the Pirates. So there's a few that came out of there.
I'm probably the youngest person in the world who habitually watches Aerial America on the Smithsonian Channel, and the New Hampshire episodes are just incredible.
Oh,
very scenic. Were you a baseball only guy though in high school?
No, I played multiple sports. I played soccer for a couple of years, soccer and basketball, and then it was just basketball and baseball. We didn't have a football team, or I'm sure I probably would have played football, but our high school didn't have that. So, no, I played two sports, and it was great. back when the seasons didn't overlap and you could actually commit to to playing three sports. It's definitely much more challenging now, but I'm a big believer in the multi-sport stuff.
When did baseball become your main sport then? When was it clear that that was going to be what you were going to play at the next level?
Probably, and well, obviously, I think, anyone that's got to the big leagues, were all, probably has always been better than their competition growing up. And I think that lended to moving through systems, whether it's high school or American Legion or even on to college. But it wasn't until I felt like I could get into the, my dream was to sign a pro contract, but I really didn't know I could pitch in the big leagues until I remember where I was. I was in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, at where the Yankees played in A-ball of Florida State League, and Doyle Alexander had come over in a trade with the Tigers, and he was down on rehab, and I watched him warm up and I watched him pitch. And he didn't throw very hard, but he was crafty, kept the ball down. I don't think he threw a ball above the knees in his whole warm up. And I said, if he can pitch in the big leagues, I can too. And I
And
did.
that was when you were playing for the team in Fort Lauderdale, the A-ball team.
Exactly. Yeah,
So
1982.
even while you were in college before you got drafted, you weren't sure you could pitch in the big leagues.
No. Absolutely not. I was just hoping to get drafted. I had no idea if I could pitch in the big leagues.
What led you to Rutgers, and then subsequently what led you to transferring to St. Leo?
Well, my high school principal played football. He was the captain of the Rutgers football team, and he had contacts with Coach Bolger, who at the time was still at Rutgers. I had a contact, I got some money, and I'd been recruited by a couple of the University of Maine, University of Connecticut. I'm not sure why I went down to New Jersey because there were more people in my dorm than there were in the town I grew up in. I grew up in a small town in New Hampshire called Salisbury, New Hampshire, that had a blinking yellow light and a corner market store. I had no idea, but I remember I went down there in 78, the fall of 78, really engaged and excited about playing college baseball. And I was really disappointed. We had a workout scheduled, but no one came because the Yankee Red Sox playoff game of 78 was on, and people, we're watching that, being from New Jersey, and I wanted to play baseball. And I was really disappointed that no one was on the field. But anyway, I was homesick. Bottom line is, I got homesick. I was too far from home, didn't want to be in school, had thought about I should have just signed a contract. The Red Sox had wanted to sign me as a free agent player, and I turned him down. And so I left Rutgers and went home and worked at a bird seed factory, doing mail order bird seed
Mail
for
order
a
bird seed. That
couple.
is the first time this
Yeah.
phrase has appeared on this podcast.
Mail order bird seed. Yeah, called Duncraft. I don't know what it was. Duncraft, and they had a small business at the time that was mailing bird seed orders throughout the country, and I would, get orders ready and ship them out. And it just, you talk about these moments in time that happen that give you pause, and this is one of those moments. It was a one-way side street down the where the shipping was. A truck would receive, the shippable goods. And I went to put an item on the conveyor to go down to the truck, and my high school baseball coach was parked next to the truck down below me. I don't know why he was out there. It's one way street going that way at the same time that I was putting the box down I'm just paused because it's coming back to me so vividly. And he kind of looked at me and just like, what are you doing here? And that was probably in late November. And then in January, I enrolled at St. Leo. I figured I didn't want to work in a birdseed store the rest of my life. So I went back to school and this time had an opportunity to go to Florida, which I know it's further away.
A little better baseball weather in Florida, though, than Jersey.
A lot better baseball weather and baseball program. And yeah, it was a good experience.
Before you got drafted, had you given any thought to what you wanted to do in the real world? Had the field of psychology, had that crossed your mind at all?
No, not really, Kyle. I think I was, you know, a lot of my mentors were teachers. You know, I mentioned the principal was a mentor of mine. My high school baseball coach was a math teacher. And then my high school physical education teacher was a mentor. Those three guys really made an impact on me. And I was probably going to go into the coaching teaching route like they had. So that was my fallback plan.
But you get drafted, you don't have to go into the fallback plan. At what point, when did you start to hear from scouts? When was it become a reality for you that you might get drafted?
Well, I had to play, because I transferred, I had to play JV the first year at St. Leo. And I gave up 20 runs in 3 innings against Manatee Junior College. So I didn't think I would, I don't know if there, and there was a scout there, Murray Cook, ended up being the GM of the Yankees, I believe. He was there scouting me, and I don't know if, I thought, no one's ever going to come back after that. But so I think it was probably, you know, toward the latter part of my junior year that I started to, you know, get some scouts showing up, and not a lot. I mean, I didn't throw hard, but I always had command and I had good size. And so it was probably toward the latter part of my junior season.
Well, the Yankees pop you in the 19th round. You're part of a great Yankees draft class. They draft a guy who should be a Hall of Famer, in my opinion, and Fred McGriff. They draft a Hall of Famer.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they draft an actual Hall of Famer, just not in baseball. They draft Steinbrenner makes a big deal about signing John Elway. Does the 19th rounder also get to meet George Steinbrenner at signing?
No, I did not get to meet George, but I did get a magnum of champagne after my first major league win that he did not give me. It was personally, it was from him, but it was in my locker. And I still have that bottle. It's still unopened. It's upstairs. But yeah, Fred, I'm with you. Crime Dog should be in the Hall of Fame, hands down. And it's unbelievable to think that he's not.
We're at the point in the year right now where anyone who follows me on Twitter knows that I've just been firing off Hall of Fame takes on Twitter, because we're in the stage of the year where people are posting their ballots. I'm just getting mad about who's not in. But how much does a 19th round pick get as a signing bonus in 1981?
$7,500.
$7,500. That goes farther in 1981 than it does now. But I can't imagine you felt like you were rich.
No, after taxes, you know, it was not a lot of money. But hey, I was in the dance. I had a chance. And you know, I went to the New York Penn League, which is now, you know, been eliminated, and which is sad. Played at Demansky Field, made, I think, $500 a month or something. But I was in the dance, which was all I really wanted. I was happy as heck.
So how much did you have about what life in the minor leagues was like, or what your path to the big leagues looked like? You'd already said that you weren't even sure that you could pitch in the big leagues. Did you have any sort of idea of, if I do this, I can get there?
Not until, you know, the next year, the first year in Oneonta, I had a good season, but you know, I was just happy to be there. You know, a lot of these kids, Mike Paliarulo was on that team, Scott Bradley, you know, they came from big programs. Pags came from University of Miami, and Scotty came from the University of North Carolina. You know, they were used to playing in, you know, much bigger capacities and probably better facilities. I didn't know better. I was totally happy to be in Oneonta with no expectations. I was playing baseball. But my path, you know, I think started to take shape after, you know, I was Yankee Pitcher of the Year in 82. I won 16 games. I won 15 games, but I had 16. I can't remember right now. You probably have the stats there.
You won 15 games. You had a sub-2 ERA for Class A Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah, and I think I had 13 complete games, pitched 188 innings. That would never happen now.
I had noted that you averaged 7.5 innings per start, which I think would make a farm director like die if they heard one of their prospects did that.
But yeah, and I mean, I ended up having elbow surgery that summer, and then years later, shoulder surgery. And I don't know if that was a cumulative effect of that. But what I do know is that, you know, back then you played your way out of the league, and I felt like I earned my way to Double A. So every year my goal was to pitch well enough to get to the next level. And you know, I got stuck in Double A for a few years, but then the Triple A, I only pitched, you know, 44 innings before I got the, you know, put on the roster and invited to spring training. So, I really didn't know any better. I just loved it. I loved everything about it. I loved the late nights. I loved the bus rides. I love going out to the ballpark every day.
You're doing my job for me, because I have to ask what like pre-Bull Durham minor league life was like. It's the, you know, everyone fell in love with the minor leagues in 1989 when Bull Durham came out. You're right there kind of in that era. What was, you know, what was your lodging like? What was the living situation? Because we think about now, you know, minor leaguers cramming into small apartments and stuff like that. There's been a big, I mean, if you know, you look at one of our more recent episodes with Ty Kelly, we did a lot about that. But what was, you know, what was that like in 1982, 1983?
Well, we were I think me and four other guys had an apartment on Cherry Street in Oneonta. You know, then it was like, you know, who's paying the rent? You know, where's the money coming from? And you know, Stan Williams was in that. Stan Williams Jr.'s dad pitched with the Yankees. Great guy. He went to SC, and he was well more worldly than me, and, you know, living in L.A. And so I was just a huckleberry from New Hampshire. So, you know, whatever money we made went to rent or the cable or food. There was no saving money at all, but you know, the bus rides were memorable. I remember hitting a deer in upstate New York, you know, in the middle of the night. You know, Fort Lauderdale it was just hot and sticky. Double A was the, you know, A ball, you know, Fort Lauderdale, the travel wasn't bad and stadiums were good. Double A, when we went to Nashville, was probably the eye opener, because you had started to have guys coming down from AAA that were older and disgruntled. Buck Showalter was a teammate of mine in Nashville. He was older. He wasn't disgruntled. I think he knew that he was not going to get to the big leagues as a player.
I was going to ask, is he always grumpy?
Yeah, he's always been intense. Yeah, but he's really funny. I think he's got a really rough exterior, but when you sit down with him, he's pretty funny. But in Double A, we had a bus with sleeper beds in the back, card table, and the bus driver's name was Snuffy. And Snuffy was kind of a heavyset guy with heavy acne, but a great guy. And he was a part-time record producer. you know, being in Nashville, I don't know what part-time meant, but we used to sit up in the front and tell stories and listen to, you know, music up front while guys in the back were playing cards. We had one player that used to read Penthouse Forum out loud on the back of the bus, which disgruntled the Christian athletes on the team. Hoyt Wilhelm was the pitching coach. And so the bunks were reserved for the catcher and starting pitcher the next day. One of our left-handed pitchers had a few too many beers, and the beers back then were bought by the team for the bus ride on the way home. The pitcher went in the back, and Hoyt Wilhelm heard about it. Now, Hoyt's a Hall of Famer, so Hoyt hears about it.
Knuckleballer.
He goes back to the back of the bus, pulls the guy out of the bunk. You know, the guy falls from the top bunk down to the bottom of the bunk, tells him to get the hell out of there, that he doesn't deserve to be there. Matt Keough was down learning the knuckleball from Hoyt, who had been a starter with Oakland and then the Yankees, but he was getting banged around a little bit. So Keough, he was pretty cool, but, you know, he was a big league guy. He was on that starting staff that all pitched, you know, incredible amount of innings for Oakland back in the day. And so some guys didn't like him, so they pennied him in the bathroom of the bus. You know, they put pennies under the door. So I didn't know what this was, but some guys did. So they basically lodged him into the bathroom, and he couldn't get out. So he was screaming, "Let me out, let me out." And then finally you heard this big thump and then a primal scream. And what he had kind of braced himself with his legs up against the sink. And when he kicked the door, he reverberated back and his head hit the window and he cut the back of his head. So he came screaming out of the bus with that. So yeah, AA was, those bus rides were interesting. Running out of gas. You heard me, running out of gas on the highway, 2 hours outside of Jacksonville on the way back to Nashville.
No cell phones either.
No cell phones. We had a game the next day. So I pitched that night. I think I pitched really well. We're on the bus. You know, we had beer. It's Florida. It's Jacksonville in the summer. It's hot, humid. The bus runs out of gas. We're on the side of the road. No AC. No food. No nothing. We have to. I don't know how the guy must have radioed in for somebody. They had to. You know, it took hours. We finally got going again. Got back to Nashville, I think, at 6:30 for a 7:05 game. They delayed the game a little bit, but all the wet stuff from the previous game was under the bus, hadn't been washed, smelled. So people were wearing some of their stuff that they had from the day before or just barring. It was crazy. A lot of pizza, you know, between games and doubleheaders. I pitched a game in Reading one time, and we scored like 6 runs in the first game. I'm pitching the second game, and between games we had Domino's Pizza, and I was pissed because I'm like, these guys aren't going to score any runs. They're all full of pizza. Sure enough, we get shut out. And so anyway, yeah, lots of... I think that, you know, the minor leagues are really, really tough, but when you look back at it, it's kind of a rite of passage that, you know, you really have to love baseball to get through it, and you really have to be good to move through it, and not everyone does that.
Kind of on that adage, though, and with the work you've done, you know, post-career with mental skills, and a little bit into the conversation we had before we started recording about the importance of your mental health and feeling good, do you think that there is, because it's one of the arguments against, you know, that about paying minor leaguers more is, oh, well, you know, if they really love it, they should, you know, they should be fine with that money, or who cares if they're living in these cramped apartments, because it builds character, it builds whatever. Do you think there's a little bit of credence to that, and that it that stuff is maybe good for character building, or is there a halfway point of, you know, it would be better for baseball, better for these guys if they were actually treated a little bit better?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's a great question and not one that's easily answered. I think that, you know, the bottom line is the way that it is now, I had to borrow money as a minor leaguer. I borrowed money from my high school catcher, Tim Hoyt. I called him Ofer. Not that he was 0-for-4 because he could really hit. I don't know why we called him Ofer, but his name was Ofer. And I paid him. He goes, look, and I think it was like $5,000. It was a lot of money. And he goes, look, just pay me back, you know, when you get your first check, and I, which I did. So I was fortunate to do that. So I think that, you know, players, because I worked an off-season job. I sold shoes at a sporting goods store. Actually, I worked in the sporting goods store that sold, you know, guns, ammunition, shoes, you know, sneakers, sweaters. I actually sold a pair of shoes to Og Mandino, who wrote The Greatest Salesman in the World. He was an author of, you know, positive psychology books. And he was in the store visiting his granddaughter and happened to ask him, you know, so what do you do? He goes, oh, I'm an author. What do you write? He goes, well, I write inspirational books. And I said, oh, I like Norman Vincent Peale. And he goes, oh, I know Norman. I go, well, I said, who are you? And he told me, and I didn't know who the heck he was. So then I looked later up and I looked him up and I was like, damn, I just saw the guy that wrote The Greatest Salesman in the World. But back to your question, you know, the players do need more money, because there's a lot of players that end up not playing because of the finances. You know, they might have a family, they didn't get a draft, you know, a bonus. You know, the bonus babies have it much differently than the other players. So, and you think about if you were paid by the hour in baseball for what you did, and I understand that, okay, you know, people listening may say, well, you know, John Lester's making $20 million a year. He's making, you know, X amount per hour. That's not the point. The point is, in the minor leagues, you have to pay your rent, your expenses, and all that stuff, and you don't make enough to meet that. And I think that players should be given a little bit more compensation to help offset those expenses in the minor leagues, for sure.
It's one of the, and we'll see if it happens. It's supposed to be one of the silver linings to cutting out, you know, 42 minor league franchises, or however, you know, it came out. Yeah. So we'll see.
Colin, I want to talk about what you said too, about some type of, I forget the word you used, but it was about earning your stripes, so to speak, about part of the struggle. And I think that that's true. It's true in anything. You know, I think that people that take internships or, you know, start out at the bottom of the rung, you know, part of it is you have to pay your dues. And if you're a minor leaguer that pay your dues and you have a big league career, you can be financially secure for the rest of your life. But that doesn't happen to everybody. And again, you know, a very small percentage of people playing in the minor leagues make it to the big leagues. And I don't think we're talking about giving them all $100,000 a year to play minor league baseball. I think we're talking about, you know, a few thousand dollars more a year to help just ease the pain a little bit.
Yeah, I think how Ty Kelly put it in that episode a couple weeks ago was that they're hoping that baseball will treat it like a career, like it is a job and not just a little part-time kind of freelance thing, because it's tough for guys to feel like employees. But it's very interesting to hear how that, you know, how that's been a thing for minor leaguers for, you know, 40 years now.
Yeah, long time.
Something else I want to ask you about as far as, and you kind of, you hit on it a little bit, that you went through some injuries in the minor leagues. You've had elbow surgery, you had shoulder problems. What was the culture around injuries and pitching sore, pitching hurt back in those days?
Yeah, don't go in the training room, basically. Yeah, it was a lot of people had injuries that they never talked about because, you know, they didn't want the team to know, because they felt if the team knows and I don't play, I'm going to lose my spot. And that, the fear of that was very prominent back then. You know, I remember taking butazolidine, which was horse anti-inflammatory. You know, they were giving this stuff out back then to deal with inflammation. And so, yeah, you didn't say anything. And that was the culture when I got to New York. You know, I was a rookie, and, you know, I think we talked about this earlier too, where you go into a veteran clubhouse and you're the rookie and you can't do anything, say anything, don't go in the training room, because you're like, you know, what are you doing in here, rookie? You know, get your ass out of here. You don't need to be in here, or all that stuff. And it creates a, you know, fear that, you know, if you're really hurt. And I know that I had that in New York, and every day that I went to the ballpark in New York, you know, after the first month, you know, I pitched well early, but when I started the struggle, it was not a good feeling. I actually, when I got sent down to AAA the first time, I was like, I know I can relax, you know. But thankfully, you know, baseball has evolved where they encourage, most teams encourage people to come into the training room to stay on top of injuries. And I mean, so much of the game has changed in every aspect since 1986. But yeah, you know, if you're hurt, don't go in the training room. Don't tell anybody. Suck it up and go play.
Well, let's talk about 86, because after almost 5 full years in the minors, you've kept runs off the board, you know, wherever you've gone. What was spring training 86 like compared to previous years?
Yeah, well, it was great because, you know, I drove my two-tone brown Mercury Zephyr, 1978 vintage two-tone brown Mercury Zephyr, I might add, into the parking lot at Fort Lauderdale Stadium, where Henderson, Griffey Sr., Dave Winfield, Ron Guidry all had Mercedes, and I went strolling in that car. I'm surprised the guy at the gate let me in. But it was great. I was confident coming off a really solid 6 weeks in AAA. And that's really where my mental game started to, you know, at least in the aspect of imagery, started to blossom. Because going back to Norman Vincent Peale again, you know, he said, if you can see it and believe it, you can achieve it. And so I created this vision in my mind of walking into Pinella's office at the end of spring training and having him tell me I made the team. That was my vision. And it was so powerful that, you know, I could see it, I could feel it, I could just be there. I can be there right now. And all of spring training, the night before I pitched, I would, you know, we had Walkmans back then, but I would take my Walkman, go out to the beach. We were on Pompano Beach. And I was on Pompano Beach at the hotel, and I would listen to my Walkman and I would visualize myself pitching the next day's game. And I pitched 20 scoreless innings in spring training, made the team, and I was number 75. And about a week before spring training ended, I got a tap on the shoulder, and the clubhouse guy said, "Hey, Lou wants to see you." And I went into the office and he told me I made the team just like I had imagined all winter long. So that's my first
you know, and I had practiced imagery a little bit in high school, but that's where it was really, really powerful. But, you know, it was great. I was making big league meal money. I was making more money in spring training than I made during the season the year before. You know, I get a standing ovation. My one of my last games at the ballpark. It was great. It was great. Loved it.
When you find out you're going to the big leagues, and then you find out you're going to be making a start. You're going into the rotation. Your debut was as a starter. How do you game plan for you were just talking about the visualization of making the team. How do you then transfer that visualization to your start? How do you game plan taking into account just the nerves of about to be able to face big league hitters?
Yeah, I wasn't, you know what? I was ready. I was against the Brewers April 11th at the stadium. And I was ready. I had a solid spring. I was confident, getting a lot of positive press. I pitched 7 1/3. I just did the same thing. I visualized the night before. I did followed my routine. I made my pitches. And, you know, I mean, it was a long time ago. I'm sure I had butterflies and was nervous. But I was ready. You know, it's something that was probably, you know, definitely a career highlight looking back at it. And you know, but it was after that things started to get, you know, after I'd been there for a little bit and started the struggle and then the distractions and the noise of the media and worried about my spot on the roster. And then my shoulder started to get sore and didn't say anything. And, you know, that's when life became really hard in New York.
You opened in New York, you played in Chicago, you played in St. Louis, you played in San Diego, Texas, Minnesota. What, from a mental fatigue factor, can you put a number on what the New York media and just the environment, that pressure cooker, how much harder that makes doing your job?
Oh, you can't compare it. It's not even comparable to anything else. It would be like, you know, I don't even know how to make a comparison to it. You know, you know, I go to Chicago after that. I get traded for Steve Trout, and, you know, not a lot of expectations. They were happy to get rid of him, but I was still hurt and got sent down. And so no one really talked to me. I wasn't part of the, you know, I was just an afterthought. But then in St. Louis, you know, I started to have success, and there was a couple of beat writers, and the fans were nice, and it was just a, you know, very great place to play, no pressure. And then from there, I went to Texas, and that was a similar thing. You know, if it was football, it may have been different, but it was baseball. And then San Diego was, you know, we had a great team, but again, not a lot of media. And then Minnesota was very low key. So, you know, I started at the, you know, it'd be like, I guess, Mount Everest compared to Kearsarge Mountain, you know? Yeah, I guess that would be it.
Well, that clubhouse you were in as a rookie in your time in New York had, just looking at the baseball reference page, is crazy. It had Don Mattingly, Ricky Henderson, Willie Randolph, Dave Winfield, Dave Rigetti, Ron Guidry, Tommy John. That's just a ton of baseball clout. Plus Lou Piniella managing. How, as a rookie, how do you go fitting into a clubhouse like that? Was there a vet you could lean on? Anyone you felt comfortable, you know, especially in the pitching staff, kind of picking their brain?
Yeah, Joe Niekro was, bless his soul, and then Phil just passed away too. But Joe was the guy. He kind of took me under his wing. He was a veteran. He used to make fun of my name. He'd go, you know, I think I'm going to paint my car Tewksbury. It sounds like a color. And he was...
He's not wrong.
No, he was... but he was great. But, you know, Rigetti was really hard on me. He and Bob Shirley, they didn't talk to me. It was kind of like, you know, really, really old school. And difficult. But Winfield was really nice to me. He gave me a suit that I had to have altered, but it was a you know, he's 6'6", I'm 6'4", you know, he's 250. I was probably 200 at the time, but so in a nice Italian suit that I still have, I probably haven't worn it. And then Ken Griffey Sr. was really nice to me. Bobby Meacham, Willie Randolph, Peg Lurillo was on that team. Of course, we had played together in the minor league. So, but yeah, there was definite veteran old school presence. And then playing for Lou was, you know, he didn't like pitchers to begin with. And, you know, he loved me when I had 20 scoreless innings. And then after my first major league win, but the next start, I pitch in Cleveland. I pitched 7 innings, I believe, give up 10 hits, 5 runs. I might have walked one, and he came up to me the next day, and he said, you know, you're not going to stay in the big leagues long if you keep giving up that many hits. And I was like, are you shitting me? I just pitched 7 innings. So, but I got payback because I pitched really good against the really well against the Reds when I was with the Cardinals. So, that was fun payback. But yeah, Lou was really tough to play for.
I didn't realize Lou had managed both Griffey's either.
Oh, right. Think yeah. About that. Yeah, you're right.
Was there any pressure to grow a mustache in that clubhouse?
No, everyone. I don't think I could have. Yeah, everyone had one. I tell you, playing with Mattingly was great too. And even now, you know, over the years of traveling around with different teams to see him, and you know, he was very complimentary about, you know, I think he was with, I shut out the Yankees in at Arlington Stadium in 95, and he came up to me the next day and he goes, you know, I'm really happy for you. I think you got a raw deal with us, in meaning in New York, and just awesome. And I'm so happy that he's had the success he's had. He's a really good man.
So you mentioned you get dealt to Chicago. What's the experience of being involved in a mid-season trade?
Well, I had just got sent down to Columbus, and it was the All-Star break. So my girlfriend, now my wife, she was visiting me in New York, and I'm like, well, I guess we're going to Cleveland or to Chicago. So she said, I'll go with you. So
it's a lot better than going to Cleveland. No offense to Cleveland.
But so she was with me. We were in the, actually I got sent down. We were in the Catskills. We were at a resort, and the bellman told me that I got traded, that I get traded to Chicago. And it was from there that she was supposed to fly home and go to work. And she said, I'm going to Chicago. So it was odd, but I was relieved at one point to get out of New York. But unfortunately for me, going to Chicago wasn't much better, because of my health status. But yeah, it felt good to get out of New York. I think everyone wants that because, you know, back then even now still, to the extent that they develop homegrown players they had Pettit and Rivera and Jeter and Posada, but Bernie Williams, you know, but they, that was an outlier development years. But I think that, you know, the Yankee farm system was great, had great coaching, first-class facilities, you know, I think that I really benefited from that player development side of the Yankees. It was just, you know, getting the opportunity to pitch for the big league team was really hard.
Well, you get traded to Chicago, and then you wind up in St. Louis. And at that point, you've shuffled between AAA and the show for a while. What made St. Louis the place where things clicked? Was it all health related? Was it getting comfortable in the big leagues? Kind of what goes into going from a fringe guy to a steady, you know, and in certain years, stellar major leaguer?
Well, it wasn't that easy because, you know, the Cardinals signed me as a free agent. I went to spring training in 89. At that point, Laura and I just got married, and I was coming off of major shoulder surgery that prior summer. And I thought, I remember she came down, I was sitting on a bench at one of the fields in the minor leagues, and I said, I'll probably be home in a week. We had just bought a house. I said, my shoulder's killing me. And, you know, she said, well, just see how it plays out. And then Mike Jorgensen was the manager of the Louisville team. And, you know, he goes, look, we're going to keep you. You're going to pitch. And so I did that, and I pitched, and I won, and I won, and I won. And Whitey's, they went to a four-man rotation. Whitey didn't call me up because he didn't think that I had big league stuff. I was, you know, I had a below average fastball. And so he didn't call me up for the longest time. And then I got called up in September. Now, excuse me, that was 89. So I got, so I was in Louisville. I won. I got called up in September. I pitched my first big league, National League, no, first big league shutout, I think, was in Montreal. Go to spring training in 1990. There's a lockout. I'm on the team at the beginning of the year. Then when the rosters were expanded, then the rosters shrunk back. I got sent back to AAA, and I won. And that's when Whitey went to a four-man rotation and didn't bring me up. And I'm like, this is crazy, you know. I'm going to go overseas. I'm going to do something. I'm 30 years old and in AAA. And so what changed was probably something that every player hopes happens to them is that, you know, you just want somebody to come and say, here's your chance. If you do well, you're going to be around. If you don't, well, if you don't, then, you know, see you later. Because again, it goes back to the struggle in the minor leagues. How long do you want to pursue this dream before you just say, you know, I've got a life to live? Well, that happened. They called me up, Ted Simmons, who I'm glad's in the Hall of Fame, and said, you know, you're going to get the ball on Friday against Montreal. If you do well, you get another start. If you don't do well, I'm not sure what's going to happen. And I said, you know, at first I was like, geez, you know, that's a little direct, isn't it? But then I felt relief and a sense of control. And I said, okay, great. So I prepared for that game and back to the imagery, and I pitched, 7 1/3 innings against the, I think it was the Expos. I gave up, we were winning 2-0. I think I gave up 3 runs in the 6th, but then shut them down and we scored. And I said, well, I pitched well that game. I'll get the ball again in 5 days. And I pitched well again, and I never went back to the minor leagues.
You begin this tenure in St. Louis where you start becoming known around the big leagues. I want to talk about throwing strikes, which is easier said than done. It is very easy, especially for coaches, to yell, throw strikes. Your walk rate was low your entire career, historically low. What about your strategy on the hill led to that? And what mentally do you attribute to being able to replicate that low walk rate your entire career? Like, how much is strategy of how you went about going at hitters, and how much was mental or mechanical?
Well, I mean, so the mental part of this is to not be afraid of contact. I wanted them to hit it. So you have to have that mindset, number one. And number two, there's a difference between control and command. You know, control is pitching in the strike zone, and that's good, but those pitches get hit. Command is the ability to put the ball where you want to so that the hitter hits your pitch. And I practiced that. I practiced throwing to a target all the time when I trained in the winter, when I played catch, when I had my bullpens. I had a very systematic routine when I threw my bullpens that was exactly the same all the time. That routine was the same thing I did on the side in my side days. And then you know, the ability to, the biggest thing is the ability to not be afraid of contact. You know, you get eight people behind you, let them hit it. So, and certainly, you know, I mean, even, and I, you know, I gave up a lot of hits, but you'll notice I didn't give up a lot of home runs. And, you know, those, a lot of those balls that they hit turn into outs. And so, and then, you know, consistent delivery, you know, the ability to repeat your delivery and make mechanical adjustments from pitch to pitch. I was able to do that because I knew my mechanics so well and they were so simple. So, yeah, it was a combination of a lot of things, but I'm really proud of the fact that, you know, I'm known as one of the best control pitchers in baseball history, at least in the modern ball era. And that's pretty cool.
Once you're established in St. Louis, you've got a, you know, you run off, I think, a string of 4 or 5 years in a row with a sub-4 ERA, a couple of those with a sub-3 ERA. What's the year-to-year start-to-start like once you've hit, you know, you're not, once you've hit your physical peak, essentially, you're an established veteran. What are the improvements that you take from start to start or year to year? What's your goal? How do you get better as a big leaguer once you've made it and you're established?
Well, for me, Kyle, it was the fact that, you know, after I had 3 years of service, I couldn't get sent down anymore. That was a big relief. I think, you know, part of the, you know, 50% of the players who play 1 year in the big leagues don't play a full second year. So there's a lot of guys that go up and down. And, you know, coaches told me the hard part about the big leagues isn't getting there, it's staying there, and they're right. So after I had 3 years of service in, I was relieved that I could have a bad game and I wasn't going to get sent down. That freed me up to perform better. And then, you know, those 91, 92, 93, even 94, although, you know, I had a high ERA, that's when the strike happened. And I think it would have been high fours, but I would have won 15, 16 games again. So then it becomes really fun. You know, you are doing something you love. You feel like you're able to be part of the peer group, that you have respect of other players in the league, respect of the umpires, appreciation by the fans, and you're getting paid to do it. You know, I never really played for the contract. I wanted it as a byproduct of my success, but it's not what drove me. What drove me was to go out and pitch and compete. So those were really fun. When you get to that point in your career where you know that there's nothing that can happen to you in the game, or in the course of a month or half a season or a season, that's going to really deter you from the bigger picture of being a successful big leaguer.
Well, you get all the way to the 1992 All-Star Game. So you go from guy bouncing between AAA and the bigs a couple years prior to All-Star. Can you walk me through your outing? I what a hat tip. I think I read an article in whatever the main magazine of, or the main paper of St. Louis is.
The Dispatch.
Yeah. I read an interview you did about essentially, and tying this into the mental side of baseball, but how your 1992 All-Star game was really, it was a good example of the mental side of baseball and really a tale of two innings.
Yeah. And I think that was one of the hardest parts to talk about in the book, was to be really reveal what was going on, because I think oftentimes athletes of all sports have two narratives. One's the internal narrative that you say to yourself what really happened. And then there's the external narrative you tell your friends and media that, and those two things don't match. So yeah, I make the team. I've got a sub-2 ERA. Glavin started, get knocked around. I remember thinking, whew, at least, you know, I can't do any worse than that. And which is probably a bad seed to plant, but I pitched an inning. I think I threw 9 pitches to Ripken, Joe Carter, and McGuire, I think.
3 decent baseball players.
Not bad. Yeah. And so I come in, I'm like, oh, it's over. You know, I pitched a clean inning, and then Bobby Cox, who called me Tom 2 nights before at the gala, maybe he thought I was Tom Pagnozzi, but nonetheless, he called me Tom, comes down, he goes, how you feeling? And I'm like, I'm fine. He goes, good, you get another inning. And I was like, are you shitting me? You want me to go back out there now? I just pitched a scoreless inning. I'm done. You know, that's my internal narrative. I'm like, oh, shit. Are you kidding me? So I go, okay. And so I remember thinking, all right, I've got to turn this around to go back out to the mound. I mean, no one that if you don't start the game, no one pitches 2 innings in the middle of the All-Star game, you know? So I had taken myself out of the game, basically. So I get back out there. I think I get the first guy out, or maybe I don't know. I get a guy on second and 1. Griffey hits a double. I got a guy on second and 1 out. I have a guy on third and 2 outs. And then I don't get out of the inning, I believe. And, you know, it went from, okay, I can just get out of this with 1 run to, I can't believe this is happening. Why did they send me back out here? You know, I felt like just totally lost. It was definitely a tale of two performances, but that's what, and I was an all-star, you know, and I just think that I wanted to, you know, those are feelings that players have in competition. I had a lot of people that have read my book, relievers, big league relievers, that said, you know, I've had that feeling where I pitch an inning and I think I'm done and I have to go back out there and I don't do well. And so it's a whole thing of, you know, keeping your fire in your belly going until you're totally, until they tell you they're definitely not pitching anymore, you know. Tough lesson learned.
Well, compared to what you know now with years of now school, mental skills work under your belt, where were you at with your understanding of the mental side of baseball by the time you got into 30s? Like, in retrospect, did you have a lot of room for improvement? Did you have a pretty good grasp on it?
Well, I think that I had a decent grasp on it, but this is when, you know, when I, through my struggles early in my career, I definitely was looking for something. I would go to the bookstores and be in the self-help section or psychology section and, you know, read Harvey Dorfman's, you know, books and, you know, was definitely looking for something. So I'm not surprised that I ended up in this field. What I do know was, you know, I definitely was doing a lot of imagery, and what I share with athletes now is what I practiced. You know, I call that little voice in our head, that negative voice, the little man. And, you know, that voice is in there all the time, and it says, don't walk this guy, don't screw up, you know, whatever it is. And so I had those thoughts on the mound, but what I learned to do was to work around them, to pitch in spite of them. And what I did was I would have that thought. I would delete it. I would bang my left leg with my glove, you know, gloves on my left hand. I would breathe, or I would swipe the pitching rubber. Then I would step off and I would, take a breath. And then I call it an anchor statement. And, you know, affirmation, anchor statement, whatever. But my anchor statement was just like on the side. And to me, just like on the side is free and easy, under control, no stress. You know, I mean, I could put the ball wherever I wanted to with ease and repeatability. And so I say just like on the side. And then I would get back on the mound and try to replicate that pitch. And, you know, I tell people all the time, you know, I didn't walk people,
But it wasn't because I wasn't behind in the count. You know, I did get behind in the count. But what I was able to do is to regain that count by controlling my thoughts. So that definitely improved. I did a lot of journaling of my outings. I kept track of my stats before there were, you know, analytics. I kept track of, oh, maybe there were analytics, but I kept my own first pitch strikes, number of pitches thrown. If I threw a first pitch strike, how many times I got the hitter out. You know, I broke down the, you know, what my run percentage was that I gave up in the first inning and how that affected my ERA. You know, I was just a student of the game in all facets. I think that was the separator. That's why at 85, 86 miles an hour, I had a long big league career.
Something else I need to know the mental side of, or where your mind was at, was you had mentioned that you were pitching in the year that ended up being the strike year. It was in your free agency year. You know, it looks like we might be staring at a labor fight coming up here real soon. Where's your head at? Where are your teammates' heads at? Where's the clubhouse at in a year where you don't, you know, you might not think you're going to finish the year? Was that reality, or was that the possibility of the World Series being canceled on anyone's mind?
No, you know, Kyle, that's, you know, I mean, this is, you know, definitely a long time ago. So there's a few things I'd like to say about that. One was that, you know, we never thought during the 80s and 90s, work stoppages and conflicts were common with baseball. There was a lockout in 1990. There was a strike, short strike in 82. There was, or 81, you know, there's always been something. And so it was not unexpected. And I think the players' thought was that the later we go into the year, the more that the owners won't want to lose the World Series because of the revenue. So if we go out now, this will get them to the table. But what we didn't know is that the owners had colluded and had, you know, planned on replacement players, scab players to come in our place, and really had no intention of, they felt like canceling the World Series, you know, they would reap that money back tenfold if they could control salaries or break the union. So it was really a sad, dark time in baseball. And it was bad timing for me because I was coming off of three of my best seasons with my highest earning capacity ahead of me. But, you know, I think that what I want players, if, you know, former players, present players, to understand that a lot of guys post, you know, 1995 played full careers where salaries skyrocketed and, you know, contracts went to the hundred millions. And I hope that they understand where that came from and how that happened, because they had no threat of a work stoppage for their whole careers. And I think players now should rightfully be concerned about where this is going to go. And I think that, you know, it's scary to think, you know, coming off of COVID and the lost revenues of 2020, and then, you know, probably significant losses in 2021, that, you know, and then the negotiations of safety with regard to COVID and the amount of games played, that I'm really concerned. And I would not be surprised if there was a major work stoppage come, you know, the end of 2021.
Yeah, absolutely. Needless to say, there's a lot of uncertainty, quote unquote, uncertain times right now, but it is,
that's a word of, uncertainty, and this will pass. But, you know, I, one thing I will say though about the game, and I've been in the game 39 years, and it's my first year not going into spring training with a team since I was 20, which is hard to believe.
But I will say that I don't like the game now. I don't like the product. It's boring. I don't like instant replay. I know that it has some benefit, but I think that the game has been neutered. And I think that the reason I don't like instant replay is because I think one of the reasons that everyone said to play athletics was because you learn life lessons. You learn discipline. You learned teamwork. You learn cooperation. And you learn that things aren't fair all the time and you have to deal with it. And the instant replay makes things fair all the time. And I just feel like, you know, so there's no lessons to be learned about, well, that's unfortunate. How are you going to deal with it? It's, well, that's all right. Well, we'll turn it over. So now everything's fair. And, you know, the launch angles and spin rates have taken away, you know, the base running and fielding. And I don't even know why they give out gold gloves now, because the ball's not put in play enough to distinguish who's a good fielder or not. And I probably sound like a really long in the tooth veteran baseball player, I realize, but
if you want to talk about a time where the game was unquestionably very fun, I actually, you know, as you get into the latter part of your career with the Rangers, the Padres, my beloved Minnesota Twins, guys start getting bigger. Balls start going farther. You're still the same kind of pitcher. You said yourself, 85, 86. Is there any sort of conscious fear about aging out of your prime at the same time that guys are hitting the weights a little bit?
Yeah, hitting the weights. No, you know, I just felt like, you know, when I broke in with the Yankees in 86, strength and conditioning was just starting to get into baseball. We had one of the first, and Jeff Mangold, and but it, you know, traditionally it was run, you know, do your shoulder program and not a lot of heavy weights. So the people that were doing that, I was, you know, like, okay, well, that's their prerogative. And we heard rumors of players doing, you know, juicing up, but I was like, why would they do that? That's silly. And then certainly no one thought pitchers were doing it, because it was, you know, why would you want to do that if you were a pitcher? But, you know, toward the end of my career, I was more about, you know, really questioning. My biggest thing was how much longer do I want to do this? You know, I had a young family, I'd won 100 games, I pitched 10 years in the big leagues, and, you know, what was my carrot? That's what I was really worried about, and that's what led me to hang him up after 98.
Well, on that 98 team, though, I just have to ask, because rooting for that 98 team was a very young me. You guys, I don't mean to be cruel. You guys made me very sad. The Twins made me.
ourselves sad.
It was a real tough go. Well, with that, though, what is the role of a veteran on a team that you know isn't going to make the playoffs? Where do you find joy in the job on those Twins teams that were 4 years away from competing?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, we had other veterans. Terry Steinbach, who's a great player and dear friend. We had fun. And I took young LaTroy Hawkins under my wing. You know, I respectfully called him Satchel, out of respect for Satchel Paige. And he called me Mr. Tukes. And there was no, I mean, talking about that now, you know, the context of that is definitely not racial or in any way. It was out of respect. And he went on and had an incredible career. And I think he mentioned my name on a episode of MLB Network about the impact that I had on him. And that's what that was about. That was about teaching others how to be big leaguers, helping them, you know, just grind it out and learn about Major League Baseball while enjoying, you know, that status with other veterans like Terry Steinbach and Ron Coomer and, you know, some of the others. So, yeah, it was, you know, we definitely didn't win, but we had a lot of fun.
A lot of my early favorite players on those teams. So I still appreciate them. You had probably my first idol, Brad Radke.
Oh, Brad Rad, he's the dude, man. He can pitch. Yeah, he was great.
Absolutely, was great. kind of an heir to you, a control guy, Brett.
Yeah, but he threw harder. but yeah, he didn't say two words and had skinny shoulders. Just a really thin built guy, but just a really good pitcher and great competitor too. He looked like the meekest guy in the world, but he's a bulldog, man. He was great.
He was. So you hang it up after the 98 year in something we talked about before we started recording. How long did it take you to come to terms with not being a baseball player anymore? You had written it out when we were talking off mic. We were talking about guys who, you know, maybe didn't make it, weren't sure what they were going to do. You had made it. You had pitched a long big league career, but was it still difficult to get over, I am not a baseball player anymore?
Absolutely. It took years, and I retired on my own will. You know, there's players terminate, their career termination happens because of, they just get cut or released, an injury. Amateur athletes kind of age out, but and then there's free choice, and I had free choice, and after the first year, I was great. I didn't have to worry about my arm or training. I was with the kids. But after that, I was like, what am I doing? You know, who am I? I'd finished my undergrad degree. And then, you know, I started working as a mentor to players. And then that led me to getting a master's in sports psych. And, I think I got that to help myself with the transition, because I was really struggling with it. And so after that, it took a little bit of time, and it's a difficult transition when your identity is one thing for so long and that's gone. A lot of people struggle with that.
When you retired, did you know that you wanted to get into work, start working with mental skills or get into the field that you did?
No idea. I knew that I didn't want to coach and be gone every day. I had no idea. It just kind of happened that, I heard about the program at BU in sports psych and thought, I could carve out a niche here being a former player, but I never thought that, the field of sports psych would grow as much as it has. I mean, almost every team now has one or more mental skills coaches. It's recognized as a part of player development, and it's really exciting to be able to have that access. It's something I wish that was available to me back in the 80s. I would have definitely been using it.
Well, and that's kind of same vein of question. What do you wish you would have known in retrospect before you'd signed? If you could give yourself any sort of pep talk or sit down, what do you tell 20-year-old Tukes about, his journey through the minor leagues?
Yeah. Focus on the 200 feet in front of you. I think Jack Kornfield or somebody said that that's as far as the beams of a headlights go, and that's all you can control is what's in front of you. Because the distractions of being an athlete are numerous, and especially as a young major league player, and that really takes away your focus of performing. So I would say, stay focused on the task.
I've got a little rapid fire for you, and then I'll let you get out of here.
Yeah.
Favorite major league ballpark?
Oh, so as a player?
As a player.
Busch Stadium.
Do you have a favorite minor league ballpark? I don't want to age shame you. I'm not sure that many of them are around now. It was kind of like the 1992 is when they all started showing up.
No.
Do you have a least favorite MLB ballpark?
Old Shea Stadium.
Old Shea. Best hitter you ever faced?
Bonds.
That's fair. Best pitcher you ever faced?
Maddox. Because I thought I could hit him.
That actually gets into one of my rapid fire questions. Do you harbor any ill will towards Greg Maddux for kind of stealing the nickname The Professor? Because that probably would have suited you had Greg Maddux not been around.
Yeah, no, not at all. Not at all. I used to record Maddux's games as scouting reports to pitch from. So he can be whatever he wants to be. He's a great pitcher.
Best food city in Major League Baseball.
Oh boy. I wasn't a big cuisine guy, but I would say, you know, Chicago, probably because the day games you could go out and at least have a normal time meal.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Hear a lot of Chicago for that question. Lastly, is there a 1980s Yankees plane story that's appropriate for this podcast?
Oh boy. Yankees. Boy, that's a long time ago.
Or if you want to sub in a great plane story from any of your other days, but that cast of characters that I listed out of the Yankees earlier, the Mattinglys, yeah, the Ricky.
Well, I can tell you what I remember about the Yankee plane trips is that I was not allowed in the back of the plane, because that's where Rigetti and all those guys were. And Rigetti would always play Frank Sinatra, and they would always have a lot of alcohol in the back. Shirley would drink some hard stuff. Rigetti was always drinking beer. And they were having fun with the music going. And, you know, rookies were not allowed in the back. And so, yeah, I kind of sat up. I ended up learning that I was not part of the group, social activities on the plane. I learned that quickly. So, yeah. Don't go to the back of the plane.
Tukes, this was great. Tell the folks where they can find your book.
They can go to Amazon. It's on Amazon. It's also an audio book. I recorded the book myself, so you'll hear my voice. And if you can go to my website, bobtewksbury.com. I have a couple of audio programs on there for pitchers and hitters for performance, and more material to be coming soon on that.
Tukes, this was great. Really appreciate you taking the time.
You got it, Kyle. Thank you. That was awesome.
And that's it for today's episode of From Phenom to the Farm. A huge thanks to Bob Tewksbury for taking the time. If you enjoyed this episode, go check out his book and make sure to subscribe to this feed. Go check out past interviews. Episodes of this show drop every other Tuesday. Also, make sure you subscribe to BaseballAmerica.com for all your amateur baseball and prospect news. And we'll catch you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.